heard that at place. We're back on Veterans Radio, and we're going back in time, folks. We're going to go back to the night of the 29th of January, 1968, the night before the Tet Offensive actually occurred. And we've got two people that were intimately involved in what was going on there. And I'm going to bring them both on our program right now. And first of all, I want to welcome Wendell Skinner. Wendell, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Good morning.
How are you doing, Wendell?
Pretty good. Anxious to get started.
It is exciting to get started. And also joining us on our phone is Wendell's commanding officer at the time, and that was Major Earl Carlson. Major, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Welcome. Nice to be there.
It's nice to be anywhere sometimes, isn't it?
Nice to be alive, yeah.
Considering the alternative, right? It's a good deal. Well, I'm really excited to have both of you on our program today, and I'm going to start off with Wendell. I'm going to have you, this may get difficult, I understand that, but let's go back to that night of 29 January 1968. Tell me a little bit about the mission you were on and what happened.
Okay, we were with a LERP outfit, 51st Infantry Airborne LERPs, and we had several teams out along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And actually, we were in the company area watching a movie, and just as the movie ended, the siren went off. Well, that meant, you know, we got to get on our horse and get out of there. And if I remember correctly, we didn't even have anybody go to the operations tent to get coordinates. We just got in the chopper, which would be me, Frank Miller, and Woody Woodworth, who was my pilot, and Tom Campbell was my co-pilot. And we just took off, and Woody was getting the coordinates as we were flying to the site. And as we were going to the site, we also got in contact with the team, and they were whispering on the radio, which meant, you know, that VC was probably right on top of them. And they told us they were pretty deep back in the jungle, and they were trying to get to the LZ, and they had a blue strobe light, and they would hit that thing every now and again just to let us know where we were at, because I think they called flying in a holding pattern. I'm not sure about that. We just had to kind of fly in a circle to wait until they told us to come in. So when we got the word to come in, we started into the LZ, and as I remember, we were taking a little bit of fire, and I was, you know, there's so much going on when you're going into an LZ, and at night it's even worse, because, right, I mean, you're trying to look for obstructions and everything, but it was a pretty clear area, and I was, a lot of chatter going on, and I looked up front to say something to Woody, and all of a sudden, all this stuff come flying over the windshield, and next thing I know, I mean, I'm laying in a bunch of wires, and I had no clue what had happened. And what happened is that area had just been burned out for some reason. And now this is near Bear Cat, Vietnam.
Oh,
and
okay.
We,
I got that mistaken
when
I put out the flyer. But it's okay, because some of the people that were there corrected us right away, didn't they? That's okay.
Anyway, that's cool, because the guys on our website, the 195th, you know, they're pretty much up to date on all this stuff. But anyway, we come in, and in talking to Woody just the other night, we go over this thing every time we talk, and he said that he just lost contact with the ground. He had no clue, and he thought he was close to setting down. Well, he just cut power, and man, he said we hit real hard, and then he went flying out of the front windshield and still in his seat.
Wow.
And his one arm just about got tore off. It was all screwed up. Of course, I didn't know all this till after the fact. I'm laying underneath the helicopter, and I really am not sure what's going on. I knew I was in a bad way, but I thought I was dreaming, and I was waking up and passing out, and I kept hearing all this chatter outside, and I kept, I actually saw a gunship fly over once, and I kept hearing that thing circle, and all of a sudden, the chatter stopped, and then I hear the slow whine of that chopper motor winding up, and all of a sudden, the helicopter takes off, and it gets quieter and quieter and quieter, and then, man, I'm in dead silence. And I thought, holy mackerel. I mean, I thought, man, what is going to happen here? I had all kind of things going through my mind. Then I just kept passing out, coming to. And evidently, it was about a 5-hour, 6-hour period. Maybe that might be a little bit much, but it was like from 9 o'clock to 1 in the morning. The major can probably expound on that a little bit better. Yeah. And, all I could think of when I woke up every time is, if the VC come inside or come into chopper and find me, I mean, I was all tore up, and I figured they would just shoot me because, you know, I wouldn't be much good to them.
Well, your leg was hurt pretty badly, wasn't it?
Well, it was pinned under the helicopter. And I was actually, I was kind of sitting in an upright position with my leg. If you just tip a helicopter over on its side and then just slide your leg under the top of the roof, my knee and my thigh was just completely crushed by the helicopter. But believe it or not, I wasn't feeling any pain, and I don't know if that's a mental mechanism kicking in or, I have no clue. So, I'm all of a sudden, I'm thinking all this stuff, and then I'm going in and out and in and out. And I never heard Major Carlson's helicopter come up, so I must have been completely out. And then I hear this noise, and I'm thinking, oh, boy, this is either good or bad. So, and I don't know who came up into the chopper. But whoever it was kind of looked down, and it was just weird. He just looked down and says, huh, we thought you were dead. And it was just like a matter of fact, you know. And so they get me out, and I'm going. I remember being put on the evac helicopter, which Major Carlson was flying, and I remember going into the 93rd evac hospital. When I woke up the next morning, I was in a ward of amputees. Everybody around me was an amputee. And I thought, I'm not looking. I just looked at the ceiling, and I was just petrified. I thought, oh, man, I've lost a limb or something. But, you know, still I was grateful I was alive. But, you know, you don't think about a lot of that stuff. And then the doc came in, and I just looked at him. I said, am I in one piece? He said, yeah, but he says you'll never walk right again. And anyway, from there I came back to Camp Zama, Japan, and then I went to Watson Army Hospital, and then I ended up at Valley Forge for a year, rehab, and stuff they did to me.
Let me stop you there.
Okay.
Because I want to go back to the night that you were shot down or crashed. And I want to try to set up the picture for our civilian audience. I want you to imagine that you're driving in fog. I mean, really thick fog. And you can't see the ground, and you're trusting your own judgment instead of the instruments, which is what they always taught us in flight school. Trust your instruments. And you suddenly stop 10 feet short of where you really wanted to be. And then you just let it coast forward, and you crash into the wall. That's similar to what happened. Sounds like what happened. I'm sure he probably got a little bit of vertigo and wasn't sure what was up and what was down, and thought, man, I'm so close to the ground, I'll just land right now because of all this ash flying around. So he brings it in hard, and when he brought it in hard, the pilot goes out the windshield. This is what...
Yeah, seat and all.
Seat and all. I mean, we used to sit in armored seats, and he goes out the windshield, just about tears his arm off. There was a lot of panic and a lot of concern on the ground, because you not only had a helicopter that had now rolled over and just about beat itself to death, probably.
You've got a team
of special forces on the ground, and everybody's trying to get everybody out and get them on that one helicopter and get them out, because they're getting shot at the same time.
Yeah, and what happened, and Woody and I were talking about this the other night. We had a belly man that went out with us, and he was actually a pilot that he wanted to go along and experience night extraction. Well, we think that when they found him, it was me.
Oh, okay. So
but in the meantime, Woody, they got out of his seat, and he was over there. He heard me screaming, and he was trying to dig me out. Well, he passed out from loss of blood. And, you know, when they found him, they just threw him. It's pitch black. I mean, you know. And I'm not sure if these guys had flashlights. I have no clue. You know, we flew these guys everywhere, but I never paid a lot of attention to their equipment they carried. I'm sure they had those red flashlights.
With a little red covering over for night vision.
Right. And, I mean, I don't know how good those are in the dark, but, you know, and another thing, where we were at was a big build-up for the Tet Offensive in that area, and I'm sure that the VC did not want to compromise their position or what was going to happen the next day.
Right.
By coming in there and just killing everybody. Because reactionary force would come out, or well, I think that's what they call it, and it would have probably blown a lot of their cover.
Yeah, I was talking to another veteran of the Tet Offensive a couple of days ago, and he mentioned that he had come around the corner. He was in Saigon or someplace outside of Saigon, and he'd driven a Jeep around the corner, and he said he saw a whole bunch of NVA regulars, and he figured, well, I'm done, and they just let him drive right on by because they didn't want to, you know, wreck their time schedule that they had for their 3 o'clock attack. We're talking with Wendell Skinner and Major Earl Carlson who of the 195th Assault Helicopter Company, and we're talking about the night that Wendell got aircraft got shot down, and he was caught underneath it. Through panic and confusion, he was left out in the field for about 5 hours before he was a rescue was attempted. And now I want to go over to Major Carlson. Major Carlson, tell me what happened around midnight that night for you.
Well, let me clarify a couple of things first. For those who are uninitiated, the LRP that Wynn was talking about is the Long Range Patrol. And these were groups of special forces, which the 195th Helicopter Company had been tasked to take out along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam, and capture the stragglers and bring them back for interrogation so we could put together a puzzle about where they were coming from, how they were moving, and so forth. And their camp is about 20 miles east of Saigon, down near the Delta area. Well, you want to clarify this point. Also say how impressed I was, Dale, that you were a member of the 195th sometime after I had left.
That's right, and I heard all the stories, and it's really great to talk with people about it that I only heard about.
Well, let me paint a better, clearer picture now. I had sent from my unit a half dozen aircraft up to a place called Strong Bay Mountain. As they clear off the peak of a mountain and build a special forces camp there, and that's where we went. And I put all of our people up there on a two-minute notice. You sleep by your aircraft, and as soon as the first mortar comes in, if the enemy chooses to take us, and they could have at any time, but we wanted to make it too costly for them, within 2 minutes, I expected every aircraft to be airborne. Get out of there and come back and use our machine guns and rockets to fend off enemy force. But we knew that there were thousands, tens of thousands of people coming down through the jungle out down south towards Saigon, the populated areas. And so I felt that we might have been attacked any time and that we were doomed, but we were going to make them pay a price for it. But the night before Tet, we got a call back, or the afternoon before, we got a call back to Saigon with our helicopters, leaving the Special Forces people there, which I didn't like too much, but that's the way it was. So that night I was sleeping, and after midnight, somebody came and woke me up and told me that we had lost an aircraft, and it was the first we had lost. We had been through some pretty good battles by that time, but we hadn't had any losses of life or aircraft. So I asked ordinary questions, and of course, one of which is, did we get all our crew back? They said, yeah, we got everybody but one who was trapped underneath the aircraft and left for dead. I was incredulous. My God, you don't go off and leave your people alive or dead. That's the first order of battle among professional soldiers. You never go off and leave your dead in a battlefield. There's any way possible for you to get out of there. And of course, I was furious with a pilot and co-pilot that they would go off and leave him there. What I didn't find out until Wynn and I got back together again a year ago was that the pilot and co-pilot and the other member of the ship were all beat up as bad as he was, and I could understand then that they, you know, they were passing out from time to time just like Wendell was. So it was a terrible scene there. So anyway, I got a good co-pilot, and I hopped in my chopper, and we went out there, and when I approached the scene, and it was a full moon, and the trees had been burned out, and but they still had the limbs projecting up toward the sky. The ground was covered with ashes. It was like something out of a Carlos Borloff, whatever his name was, movie.
Right.
You know, a ghost scene. It was pretty obvious to me that as soon as we came in there, we were going to be flying blind. And so I told my co-pilot, I said, you watch carefully what I do now and get your mind set on where you are and what your rate of descent is so that you can get down to the ground. And you're not going to have a lot of load on the aircraft, so you won't have to worry about stalling out and crashing. And you bring it on in, because I'm going to get out and take the crew chief with me. I'm going to go out and bring back Wendell. And so we had a good landing there, and I was surprised at myself because we were blind about the last 50 feet going in. And of course, we were risking another aircraft or another crew, but you know, we often take chances in combat, and you do what you have to do.
Absolutely.
And this doesn't quite track with what Wendell just said, but I'm not quite sure. You know, that was, what, 43 years ago?
you know.
But as I recall, what is this, 33 years ago? I don't know, but anyway, and I'm 81 now, so you'll forgive me if I have a few cobwebs up there. I was sure that I heard this scream, this loud, piercing scream, which made my hair stand up on end. And immediately I recognized that he was out there and that he was still alive. And so I got the crew chief, and we piled out of the aircraft with a toolbox and told the co-pilot to get up and take it up and wait for a call. I would call as soon as we were ready for you.
Can I just interrupt here for a second?
Yeah.
I want people to realize that you were on the ground. And you left. You told your perfectly good helicopter to leave you on the ground.
Yeah.
And he took off and circled the area while you were on the ground trying to get Wendell out.
Yeah. Also, we recognize there could have been anywhere between 10 and 15, 20,000 NVA, North Vietnamese Army out there in V.C. And it was a pretty tenuous situation. But, you know, we weren't getting any fire at that time, so we got a hold of the tail section of the aircraft and lifted up, the crew chief and I, far enough for a window to slide out from underneath the aircraft. And then we took what arm that we could in a hurry, and I called my co-pilot to bring it in, and we got what arm that we could off the aircraft and took Wendell back. Wendell, you may not know this, but they came out the next morning with the helicopter wrecker crew and lifted that thing out of there and took it back for salvage.
We do have that, by the way. Those of you that are watching our webcast, we do have that picture at some point. I know Gary's looking for it feverishly right now of the wrecked aircraft and of the Chinook sling load years out.
Jeff, can I say something about those photos? Terry Whelan, one of the pilots, he took all these photos the next day. So I want to give him credit in there, you know, that he actually took these photos of the chopper and everything the next day.
I have to tell both of you that I was able, when I went to the 195th website, I was able to find a lot of photos that we're using with today's webcast. So you're not watching it, but I can see right now we're looking at the Chinook lifting your aircraft out of there. So I'd like to thank Mr. Wieland also for the photographs. They're amazing photographs. And I have to look at these to remember what we did 43 years ago. Isn't it amazing? anyway, so you got Wendell out.
Uh-huh.
Right, Colonel?
Yes,
Major?
And I took him over to the Medivac Hospital, which is not very far from our base. And I left him there and tried to get back and get a rest because I had to get the base prepared. We had two helicopter company. That's 68 aircraft, and I was a base commander as well as the commander of the 195th, and we had to get our positions, you know, provisioned and ready for a potential attack. We hadn't been formally notified, but I knew from the movement that we were going to be attacked. The whole area was. I mean, that was my own instinct. And so I had to put Wendell and the other guys, you know, on the back of my mind. When I tried to find a pilot and co-pilot, they told me that they'd been taken to the hospital. And so I just had to let that go. And, of course, 3 o'clock in the morning, we got the attack, and all hell broke loose. And it was... there are a lot of stories there, but let's not go to that.
Well, we'll get to that after at the bottom of the hour after we come out of a break. I do want to talk about the Tet Offensive. So how did you guys hook up again? Real briefly, Wendell?
I was on the website, and I saw the major's name, and I was he was posting about, you know, about me. And he didn't know who
Wait a minute, Wendell.
He called him the kid.
I was trying to find out what happened to the guy with his leg cut off.
Well, he was just looking for the guy with a leg. I'm gonna cut you guys off right now. We're gonna take a break, but we'll be back on Veterans Radio, and we're talking today with Wendell Skinner, who was injured in a severe crash in Vietnam, and his commanding officer who came out in the middle of the night and got him the night before Tet. So stick around.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Army Captain Ed Freeman flew 14 rescue missions under intense enemy fire, saving 30 seriously wounded soldiers. Details after this.
It's not easy being a veteran.
Coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan. I had been so excited to come home.
But it's harder than I thought.
Join us at communityofveterans.org and connect to others who are going through the same thing.
Brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
As a flight leader, Freeman supported a heavily engaged American infantry battalion in the I Trang Valley in the Republic of Vietnam. The unit was almost out of ammunition after taking some of the heaviest casualties of the war, fighting off a relentless attack from a highly motivated, heavily armed enemy force. When the infantry commander closed the helicopter landing zone due to intense direct enemy fire, Freeman risked his own life by flying his unarmed helicopter through a gauntlet of enemy fire time after time, delivering critically needed ammunition, water, and medical supplies to the besieged battalion. His flights had a direct impact on the battle's outcome by providing the engaged units with timely supplies of ammunition critical to their survival. After medical evacuation helicopters refused to fly into the area due to intense enemy fire, Captain Freeman flew 14 separate rescue missions, providing life-saving evacuation of an estimated 30 seriously wounded soldiers, some of whom would not have survived had he not acted. All flights were made into a small emergency landing zone within 100 to 200 yards of the defensive perimeter, where heavily committed units were perilously holding off the attacking elements.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
There's a familiar tune for some of you out there, just as distorted as it was when we listened to it 40 years ago. Anyway, we are here on Veterans Radio, and we're talking with Wendell Skinner and a Major Earl Carlson, and we're talking to them today about Left 4 Dead is kind of what we titled the program, because Wendell aircraft had been shot down, crashed, rolled over on top of him, and they were able to get most of the crew out except for him. And when the Major heard that one of his crewmen was left out in the field, he and another pilot grabbed a ship and went out and got them. And now we're just talking about how they were able to connect with each other.
Before you go back to Wendell, let me make a couple comments. First of all, we organized from nothing at Fort Carson, Colorado, and the people and the material and the aircraft and everything was going in, coming in fast, and I didn't have time to get to know the people like I normally would have, because I was supervising all these activities going on, getting ready to go overseas. And so I didn't know the names of a lot of the people that I should have known.
Well, you had a lot of people in your company, though, too, sir.
Yes. Well, I only had about 300 and some of my own, but then another 300 and something in the other unit that was assigned to our base. And so I didn't know who it was that I had picked up out there. I didn't know who the pilots were. And so there were a lot of names missing. So when I put my first notice on the 195th website, I said, I'm looking for the man who had his leg cut off. And that's as much as I had, because I've been thinking about him all those years. And so this guy answered one of the things, and he was trying to help me find out who it was. So go ahead, Wendell, pick up from there.
Well, I couldn't figure out why about the guy with the leg cut off, and I thought, well, you know, I was a guy that was picked up and saved out there, and so I don't know. We must have went back and forth on the website, I don't know, two or four times. And then I think at the same time we figured out that he was looking for me and I was looking for him. And I'm telling you, it was one of the most emotional things to know that. I mean, oh my, all this stuff just kept flooding through my mind. And I've got chronic post-traumatic stress, and it's
a big surprise.
This is a little bit of closure for me, and I'm sure it is for the major. I mean, the guys that started the website, the 195th website, Ty Furbish, and I think Jay Hammond,
and I can't think of the other guy. All of you guys were my heroes. I didn't even know who they all were when I got there. I only heard stories about all of you.
Well, you know, I was the last person. I replaced a crew chief. I came right out of Fort Rucker, out of crew chief school, and my order said, you're going, sent to a deploying unit. And it was a 195th Aviation Company in Fort Carson, Colorado. And, you know, when I got there, I think the first guy I ran into was a guy named Steve Hathcock, and he got me in there and got me to the commanding officer's office and got me set up. And I really never got to know a lot of the guys, because I was only there, I don't know, 2 months before we left, and a lot of that time was packing Connexes and, you know, stuff like that, getting ready to go overseas. I had never seen my chopper till I got to Vietnam. And, there's just so many things that come into your mind, that you forget after 40 years.
Well, that is true, and fortunately or unfortunately, Wendell, you were sent off to a medevac hospital and then off to Japan, and as all that was occurring, Major Carlson had to deal with another project the next day around 3 o'clock in the morning. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
You mean me?
Yeah. You were the one that was there.
Yeah, yeah.
We had a little disruption.
Let me limit my comments. How much time do we have?
We've got about 20 minutes total.
Oh, well, I'm not going to take anywhere near that much, but a couple comments to the kind of unit the 195th was. I was sent by DA, and I reported to the new commander from my base. I'd flown up from Texas, Fort Walters. And so he said, you're not going to command a unit under me. You're a tech service officer. I'm not going to have you. I'll get a combat officer. So I went back to Texas and called the Pentagon, and they said, well, he didn't have anything to say about it. You're going to be the commander whether he likes it or not. Yes, sir. So a couple months later, I walk in and I say, Colonel, here are my orders from Department of Army. I'm going to command this unit whether you or I like it or not. I said, you stay off my back for 60 days, and if you don't like the way we're doing, I'll call the Pentagon and ask to be relieved. And we made a pact right there. And that's a hell of a position to get into when you're going to take a unit into combat.
Yeah,
then they sent me almost all of the pilots were right out of flight school, had never had 1 minute of flying time from the time they graduated to the time they started flying with us, which was a great liability, but it was also a great asset because they hadn't picked up any bad habits. And I had a number of officers who were had just come back from Vietnam. They weren't very happy about it. So, you know, you got a bunch of lemons there. You got to do something with it. So we turned out making lemonade of them, and we had a tremendous training tour up in Colorado. We got to Vietnam, and the second night after we got there, they had a huge mission. I don't know how many hundred helicopters were out there. There must have been a bunch, but we were 34 of them. And we picked up our people and took them out there, and I had no idea how my young people were going to do first time in combat, a lot of the young men had been drafted in. They didn't particularly want to be there. But we built a fair amount of esprit de corps. And we approached this area, and the rockets and machine guns were going off, and the flares were all over, and it was one hell of a battlefield out there. And here we've got all these people we don't know we had picked up along the way, and we're dropping them in there. And I've looked back a number of times at the way in which those men conducted themselves, my pilots and the crew chiefs, and no one got out of line, no one got scared, no one screwed up, and for hours we were shuttling those people in and out of there with great discipline, and I was so proud of those guys. And I just had to take a few minutes to tell you how great they were.
Well, I can tell you that the tradition that you started when you first got to Vietnam continued on the whole time I was there. I've never met a finer group of men in my whole life. Because
well, I was
every single one of them were willing to lay their lives on the line for anybody else.
I was a hard nose because I was over there once before. This is my second tour, and I made them run every morning. I made the officers run with the enlisted men and all of us, and I remember falling down myself and they all laughing at me. But I wanted them to have self-confidence and to feel that they could get back to our home unit if they got shot down, those kind of things.
Well, there was, you had to have a certain arrogance to be a pilot anyway. You know, you had to be confident. You were flying around in a box that was a pretty good-sized target, so you had to have a lot of courage, I think, that most people didn't think about. And we didn't think about
we
were doing it.
Had a nice overhead fan there to keep us cool, you know.
That's right, yeah. Kick it out of trim and everybody was cooled off.
Dale?
Yes, sir.
In the hospital when the next day when the Tet hit, and I think it was they overran the Benoit Air Base at one time, and there was an air base there at the hospital if I remember correctly. At
that
the 93rd. And they overran that, and they came and got all of the patients, and they just put us in a bunker. No weapons, nobody was with us, and I thought, man, you know, if they get in here, it's going to be a mass slaughter.
Oh, yeah.
They finally got everything straightened out. And but, you know, that's just stuff that comes to your mind and all this stuff, you talk about all this stuff.
Well, we had some pictures that were on our website, but I decided that we probably didn't want to show them here on our program because they were pretty graphic, although probably people should see them, of the result of the VC and NBA probably in the wire at Long Bin, which was, you know, with that plantation where we lived at the time. They were everywhere, it seemed.
I never was a plantation that much. I was always out. We were at Bami Tuit with the Special Forces, and we flew into Cambodia every day for like 3 weeks. And then we came back to company area for like a week, and then we went over to the LERP outfit. I think the major thought I was out of Song Bay, possibly. I don't know. Was that one of the things that you was thinking about?
Well, no, not really, because I had been told that you were attached for that mission you were on to another unit, the battalion unit, and that you were just a tag-along with them. And I didn't really clear my mind. I had a lot of things on my mind right then.
I can't understand.
Oh, I can't imagine.
we've got a picture of Major Carlson up on our webcast right now, as he looks probably today. And so if you get the opportunity to go there, you can go back and check our webcast after the program's over, and you can see some of the pictures that we've been showing there. And I did see a rather embarrassing one of a pilot. I think his name was Woody, you had mentioned before, the one that where he was sleeping. He was probably exhausted after flying 20 hours of a day. And I saw it come up there, and I went, uh-oh, he's not going to be happy to see that one.
You know, I'll say something about Woody here. He really... And he talks about this every time we talk. I mean, he's got a lot of guilt about the way things went, and, you know, he lost sight of the ground, and he's really, I'm sure he's got a lot of problems thinking that it's his fault that everybody got screwed up, but, you know, I never once had any problem with what went on or what he did. I mean, you know, like the major said, when you're in combat, there's a certain amount of chaos, and when he did what he thought he had to do, he thought he was doing the right thing, and, you know, it was just a decision that he had to make, and
we're coming up on another break, so I'm going to have to cut you guys off here for just a second. I want you to make sure that you stick around, you two, and also to our audience. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back after these messages.
He blesses the boy as they stand in line. The smell of gun grease and their bayonets, they shine. He's there to help them all that he can. To make them feel wanted, he's a good holy man.
There's another familiar song for some of you from the 195th out there. Probably other units listen to that song as well on your nice TIAC reel-to-reel recorder with your headphones on all along the way. We're talking with Wendell Skinner and Major Earl Carlson of the 195th Assault Helicopter Company, later changed to the Aviation Company, a helicopter company, whatever they wanted to call us. I think they were trying to clean up our image a little bit. But Wendell had been shot down, and the aircraft had rolled over on him, and Major Carlson had gone out in the middle of the night and gotten him out of there, and they just met up with each other again about last year after 42 years, 1 year, something along those lines. Those numbers are getting so high now, I can't even count them anymore.
I don't want to.
Dale, yes, I'd like to two quick things, if I could, please, Wendell. Wendell, first of all, was the swimming pool still there at what's the place you were? Did they bend me to it?
No, I was never around a swimming pool.
They stole that swimming pool from the Air Force, sent a couple of trucks over there, over the mountains, and offloaded onto their own trucks instead of the Air Force getting them. The Air Force never figured out what happened to that great big swimming pool.
That sounds a lot like in 1969 when we swiped a pallet of plywood from the Koreans and built an officer's club. But then,
oh, my goodness.
Yes,
well, I went into Bamitua twice, one time going from Pleiku, my first tour, up to Saigon. All aircraft were forced to have a quick landing as soon as possible because the Prime Minister had been assassinated. And a few months later, going from Saigon back up to Pleiku because President Kennedy had been assassinated. So that was two little trips to Bamitua, and they had a beautiful club and pool and everything. But that was the first time, and things tightened up a hell of a lot after that, so I wasn't sure. The other thing is, would you please ask Woody if he would call me or email me, if you would give him my telephone number and email address? I think you have both of those, right?
I can do that.
We will do that. Not a problem. So, Major Carlson, I wanted to ask you about the Tet when they attempted or did overrun Benoit and Longbin. How long were they able to hold the land, or were we able to fight them off at that time?
Well, Longbin was oriented north and south, basically, and we were on the west side of that airfield with adjacent to them. And then they had an evacuation hospital across about a half to three-quarters of a mile. It was nothing but brush and underbrush and little rolly hills there.
Mm-hmm.
And at 3 o'clock in the morning, all hell broke loose, and the rockets and mortars started going off, and machine guns then started, and we were getting 50 calibers through the water tank, and it was just one heck of a mess. And I was afraid we were going to run out of ammunition because we'd lost our contact, the wires had been cut, and so I went out to the front to tell the guys to, you know, they were shooting like mad. I said, don't shoot until you see something out there. Don't just shoot ammunition. Well, they said, yeah, we saw these couple of guys jump up there, and we opened fire, and then we got a lot of fire back. Well, what I finally surmised was that a couple of VC had snuck in there, and one of them had a pink shirt on, and I think the other one had a blue one on, if I'm not mistaken. And they were jumping up to draw fire, and then the fire was going to the hospital, and the hospital was firing back. Well, that was a 50 calibers and big ones. I thought, well, now a couple of snipers like that wouldn't have had 50 calibers. So So I called the hospital on the radio and said, got a hold of the CO and said, would you please stop firing for 15 minutes, and I'll do the same as of right now, and we'll see what's causing this. And nothing but silence. So I realized then that I'm not sure that was the same hospital I took Wendell to or not, but for whomever,
you were
we were cross-firing back and forth across there, and finally got that stopped. The thing that really upset me, it was the worst day of my life, was all this firing going on and rockets and machine guns, and I'd call the NCOs and officers in the mess hall to make sure our strategy was and who was going to be responsible for what and so forth. And all of a sudden, this tremendous explosion and rattled the buildings and everything. Everybody hit the floor, and I jumped up and ran across the bodies and got outside just in time to see a nuclear weapon. The cloud go up, and I had gone through tests out in Nevada of the nuclear weapons. And I thought, oh my God, Russia's into this. And I've been reading about the spy ship had been captured by North Koreans, and we had done nothing, America had done nothing about it. Reading in Newsweek about the college campuses and the riots and so forth. And I thought, man, here we are surrounded. We have no chance of getting out of here. We're going to be outnumbered, and they're giving up on us. And then I found out after about 2 hours that a million gallon of a tank of the JP-4 had been set off by sappers. And that's what I saw. And it sure created a nice mushroom cloud.
There was an ammo dump out, I forget what direction it was, off to the east, I think, of the plantation runway, somewhere out there.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I can remember it accidentally, I think it was one of the gunship's crewmen that set off a rocket, went off between his legs through the revetment and out into the ammo dump and set off a nice 4th of July fireworks, but unfortunately I think it was April. But that was 1969. That was a year later. Because our Tet offensive was not nearly as obviously as intense as the 1968 one. They just lobbed rockets into the revetments and so forth, and we were told to evacuate, but we couldn't evacuate because there were too many rockets coming in.
You know, our sister unit there in Long Bend hadn't been as well trained, apparently, as our guys had, and they were clumsy, and they set off one of those rockets and went right through the compound out the other end. Well, I'll tell you what.
I think that was the 117th, wasn't it? Was that the
117th? You mean the unit that fired the rocket?
Yeah, that was they were across the street from where we were located. Well, we're coming up against the top of the hour. Both of you gentlemen, I want to thank you so very much for being on Veterans Radio. Are there any last things that either one of you want to say? I'm going to go to Wendell first.
I'm just thrilled that I got this story out there, and I'm definitely soon I'm going to try to go see Major Carlson and give him a big hug, because, without his efforts, I would not be here today.
Well, thanks, Wynn. We got a guest wing of our house where you and your family are welcome to come and stay with us. You get down this way.
Well, hopefully I can take care of that. I'm working toward that goal.
I would like to say this, too, that for all the guys, and particularly young men who were drafted in our unit, on that first mission we had that scary night, a lot of young men became men that night, and it was one heck of a sight. And from there on out, we were solid.
Well, we all appreciate those comments, because it's so important for people to realize that we fought as one unit. There wasn't any dissension when we were out on a mission, and there was no dissension anywhere. Bob wanted to ask a quick comment, I believe. Hold on, both of you.
Yes, I do, and I want to thank our guests very much for being on the program today. I've been sitting on the edge of my seat. I really don't know how I'm going to come down from that. What an incredible story. Thank you very much for sharing that with us. God bless.
I'm just glad to thank you guys.
Well, this is what we're trying to do, and this is a great example of getting the stories out about two ordinary men who did extraordinary things in an unusual situation. And we are grateful to have both of you on the program, and we want to make sure that now that you are here, it is archived and it's for posterity. 200 years from now, some distant relative can pull this up out of the Library of Congress and go, hey, that was my great-great-great-great-grandfather.
That's cool stuff. That is, I'm far from a hero. The major's the hero. I mean, I was just doing a job.
Hey, that's what everybody says. My other partner, Gary, says, you pilots, you never talk about what you really did. And we just said, we're just doing our job. Just like everybody else. All the other military people we've talked to, they were just doing their job.
When were you drafted or did you volunteer?
I volunteered.
Well, I have a special feeling for all the men who are drafted. Those of us who volunteered should have known what we're getting into, you know. But the draftees, I really feel for those guys, those both who living and those who didn't make it.
Well, I think that's a great tribute, Major Carlson. I want to thank you so very much. Wendell Skinner, thank you also. And we're going to get this book published for you and get that story out for you. Major Carlson, we're going to have you back on the program because you've got other stories. I want to thank you both for being on Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Doc.
Thank you. Thank you.